Welcome to Clarity Fund Podcast. I'm Dr. Owen Anderson, and you're joining me in our series about anxiety and the modern world. Last time we looked at Kierkegaard, and this time we're going to look at Blaise Pascal. So in that sense, we're going back in time from Kierkegaard. But he is a 17th century French mathematician and physicist. And yet he's also one of the first persons to write about anxiety, as we'll be thinking about it here. Remember, anxiety has to do with, I've called it the inner life of the age of skepticism. It's a response to a threat to our most basic values. And that threat, as a conflict, as a challenge, shows that we don't know what we thought we knew. And that not knowing, particularly at that basic level, we don't know what is ultimately good or real, what will happen to us at death. Not knowing those things gives us a kind of anxiety and a worry, a fear. All of those go together, and I looked at them in my first discussion about this anxiety, distinguishing those from each other. And we're calling it sometimes an existential anxiety, not because it's connected to the school of existential philosophy, but because it has to do with the very nature of our existence. It's not the same as a kind of daily anxiety someone might have. That's more like worry or stress. But an anxiety connected up to realizing, I don't know, and maybe even thinking that knowledge is not possible. We can't know what is real. We only have opinions. Today, in looking at Pascal, we're going to think of how he is operating, because he is living in a time where there was a great amount of confidence in reason. And the understanding was that reason could solve our problems. Now, I've called that mathematical reason or mathematical reasoning to distinguish it from other senses of the word reason. And the idea was that through the understanding of mathematics and physics, which is one of the scientific fields most closely tied to mathematics, we can come to understand the world around us. And we don't really need to have anxiety because we have knowledge. So contrast that age, an age of confidence in our ability to know, with the modern age, sometimes called the age of reason, of anxiety. And the reason is because it's an age of skepticism. Those 300 years, 400 years between the two time periods revealed that what we thought we knew, we didn't know, or what we knew didn't get us where we wanted to go. There's more. And now we've come to think, well, maybe I don't know at all. And that not knowing is what produces the skepticism or the anxiety. Now, Pascal is going to be an interesting figure because in an age where there was not much anxiety, this is not called the age of anxiety, the 17th century, it's an age of optimism about the ability for reason, as mathematical reasoning, to come to understand the world. Pascal is wrestling with anxiety. And it's partly precisely because he doesn't think mathematics can solve our problems, mathematical reasoning. From now on here, I'll just call it reason as he's using it. But remember, the way he's using reason is specifically thinking about mathematical reason. And so he does suffer. So in one way, suffer anxiety. So in one way, that's a proof that of the point I made about confidence and knowledge being on the other side from anxiety and skepticism. Now, the rebuttal is, of course, yes, that is true, but it's a false confidence. And that could be very well what happens. Absolutely. People might think they know and they don't know. And that's precisely why the unexamined life is not worth living. So Pascal has a great number of things to say about reason, good things, and speaking highly of it as what distinguishes humans from non-humans. But he also wrestles with the reality of the non-rational world. I want to read a quote. He said, "When I consider the brief span of my life, swallowed up in the eternity before and behind it, the small space that I feel or even see, engulfed in the infinite immensity of spaces which I know not, and which know not me, I am afraid and wonder to see myself here rather than there. For there is no reason why I should be here rather than there, now rather than then." So in considering our lives, we see, in one sense, before us and after us, a great expanse. He calls it infinity, and we think about how small our life is in the middle of that. And you wonder, what could our purpose be? Such a small speck in an ocean of time. And the implication is that there isn't one. There is no purpose or meaning. And any purpose or meaning that you do have, it has to be invented by you. You have to find some piece of broken wood to grab onto in the middle of that ocean of time. But you're here suddenly, you're thrown into this world, and then you're not here just as suddenly. And the world is very different, or not very different, for your having been here. And so that assessment can make someone say, look, it doesn't seem like there's much of value in my life that is ultimate. At most, I can make the most of it, I can enjoy it. And so we want to distinguish this assessment from what we find in Ecclesiastes, where the preacher says, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Or meaningless, meaningless, all is meaningless. A chasing after the wind. All is meaningless under the sun, he says. I want to just keep that in your mind as we're going, because I think these two actually turn out to be very different. Now for Pascal, he's emphasizing the non-rational or irrational reality of life. The emotions, for example. And so he has a famous saying where he says, the heart has reasons that reason or the mind can't grasp. And it's an ironic statement, right? Because if it has reasons, then it's still using reason. And that's part of the problem here. Instead of speaking of rational and non-rational or rational and irrational, let me speak of it as cognitive or non-cognitive. The cognitive is where we form beliefs. And that gets us closer to the definition of religion or of reason in itself. Not mathematical reasoning, but reason itself is the laws of thought. It's that by which we form beliefs and arguments. And we can't escape that when we're thinking. So if I'm thinking about my emotions, I'm using reason. Now, emotions don't arise from reason. They could arise just from, for example, my body. But when I start to think about them, as he says, the emotions or the heart has reasons the mind can't grasp, well, he's beginning to give reason to them in this broader sense, not the narrow sense where he's pitting emotions versus reason, mathematical reasoning, which is kind of like a cold calculation. And interestingly, he invented an early kind of calculating machine. So that's not what is meant by reason in this broader sense of reason as the laws of thought, that by which we form beliefs to think about our emotions. And that's the non-cognitive side. The emotions aren't beliefs. Or if you have impressions, like you might be a food connoisseur and you try some food and you're able to get an impression from it. And someone asks you to diagnose it, then you have to begin giving qualities, explaining, why did I give it a 5-star? Why not a 3-star? But the initial impression that made you give a 5-star is non-cognitive. And the later is almost like a self-justification later of adding in the cognitive to try to justify to others why you gave the rating that you did. And so Pascal wants to say, look, most of life is not predictable. It's based on chance. And that makes sense given his interest in mathematics and chance and calculating machines. And reason isn't a guide when it comes to that. Now, that's not to take away from reason, he doesn't think. Reason does a lot of good things, but it can't really guide us in the area of life. Life's too unpredictable. It doesn't get us to the kinds of certainties we need. We should pursue wisdom, but we should also know the limits of where we can get. And so he's best known, perhaps, among philosophy students for what is called Pascal's wager. Pascal's wager, he's given an answer to, should I believe in God or not? And he's speaking to, thinking of, an audience that likes gambling. And so he puts the answer in those terms. So in other words, he may not have thought this is the only answer. Some people take Pascal that way, like this is how he thought you'd prove it. Versus he may just be gearing his answer toward the audience he was thinking of. Either way, let's think about what is Pascal's wager. And he thought about it in terms of outcomes. And there's four possibilities. Either you believe in God or you don't. That's two. And then each of those has two possibilities. You believe in God, and indeed God is real, then you have a good afterlife. Or you believe in God, and God isn't real, and you have no afterlife. Or you don't believe in God, and God is real, and you have a bad afterlife. Or you don't believe in God, and God isn't real, and you have no afterlife. So the only one of those, there's two negative outcomes, and there's one neutral outcome and one good outcome. And so the only good outcome is that you believe in God, and God indeed is real. And what do you lose by believing in God? So you may as well go ahead and believe in God, and that can have that positive outcome that if God does exist, you don't know, but if he does, then you have a good outcome. Now, there are three objections we can think about to this. One is simply that it does cost something. When he says, what do you lose by believing in God? Well, you lose a lot of time, money, you base your life on a fiction, and that's a big loss. You only have this one life, it turns out, because when you're dead, you're dead. You don't exist anymore. So those are big losses. Another one is that it's not simply a matter of believing in God or not believing in God. Which God? Which religion should you believe in? You might believe in the wrong one, right? So that doesn't help you at all. Then you're in big trouble. So it's not just believing God or not believing God. It's believe in God number one, God number two, God number three, God number 1,000. And then by not believing in the right one, you make the other real God mad, and you're no better off. And then third, it's a kind of disingenuous, mercenary belief in God. I believe in God because then I'll get a good afterlife. It'll be great. And no human friend would consider that friendship. So certainly God wouldn't consider that the love of God. You don't love God, you just love God for what you get. Remember, that's what Satan accused Job of. Although Satan was wrong in that case, he might be right in many cases. That's all people care about. So Pascal's wager doesn't actually help us with the problem of skepticism. It's more like, how do I deal with the fact that I don't know? It's like an insurance actuary. I don't know when I'm going to die. And so the insurance company takes my health records and they can make a pretty good prediction based on all the data they've collected over all the years they've been doing insurance. And then based on that, having a good window of when they think I'm going to die, then they will sell me life insurance. In a way, they still make money off the life insurance. So it's sort of like that. We don't know. Because we don't know, here's a way to deal with the skepticism. And so you have the background anxiety. Now, but isn't this just like Ecclesiastes? And what do we offer Pascal? Do we tell him that he should just double down, keep doing mathematical reason? No, not at all. He's right in his criticism of mathematical reasoning and its overextension into other areas of life. And that did fail, and that led to the kind of anxiety we have today. So it isn't that Pascal should just ignore his anxiety. In fact, that's what he's getting at with emotions. When he says, look, emotions are real, he's thinking about the attempt to either ignore or repress emotions, which does not lead to good outcomes. And so you just act like, I'm just a calculating machine, I don't have any emotions. Well, that's not healthy. Of course you do. And then you might say, well, I do have emotions, but I shouldn't feel them. Now, that could be true. There could be some emotions that are misguided. Or it could be this, you have emotions. The emotion itself isn't misguided, but it's what you do with it that's misguided. So we can get into that analysis of emotions, but the problem is if you try to either say, I have none, or you just try to make yourself not feel emotions. And so he's objecting to that, and that's right. He should object to that, because as humans, we have emotions, and we need to think about them. That gets us into that cognitive realm. We're using reason as the laws of thought to think about our emotions. So all that is to say, he could have some good objections to mathematical reasoning, but what is there to get him out of this anxiety? Well, it would be that he's misunderstood reason. It's too narrow a view of reason. And we've seen this already in the other episodes we've done about narrowing the view of reason. So even when there's an age called the age of reason, the view of reason in that age is too narrow. Interestingly, we saw this back to Plato in the beginning of the Academy. The Academy founded on with over the doorposts, supposedly the sign says, Let only those who know geometry enter here. Only those who know geometry. The idea being that geometry teaches you eternal mathematical truths. The world of change is not perfect. It's changing and it's temporal. But the eternal realm is the world of math, geometry. And so there's been this continual thought, that background in Western intellectual life, that math is somehow what gets us to the eternal. And Plato taught something like that. Pascal taught something like that. And, or not Pascal, Pythagoras. And then what Pascal is seeing is, yeah, that we should hold mathematics up, but the life, the real life, and perhaps he saw this more precisely because he was a Christian, whereas Plato and Pythagoras might have thought that the human soul isn't all that real compared to the mathematical forms. The reality of humans as made in the image of God and having a future, there coupled with the unchanging nature of math, raises that problem. It doesn't seem to connect with human life. And there's other things in human life, in the world of change, that have to help us explain the world of change. Mathematical reasoning doesn't very well. And so we could wrestle with that, with him. We can see, yeah, he's identifying a real problem in Western intellectual life. But the solution can't be skepticism. It can't be Pascal's wager or Kierkegaard's blind leap. It has to be that we find how to know. And that's really going to be the solution for all of the anxiety we've talked about in the age of anxiety, because it's an age of skepticism. And the solution is twofold. The skepticism is healthy because it does show us where we came short. We thought we knew and we didn't know. So that's right. But this is not a place to end. This is a place to begin. Is the beginning place for seeking to know. I should have known. It's not just out of a kind of mere intellectual curiosity where you say, no, I really like to know some things. I want to start knowing some things. No, that's not it. It's because we should know them. We're rational beings, and my failure to know it is culpable. I should have known these things. I should have known the basic things, and the basic things have to do with God and humanity, good and evil. I should know those things. And not knowing them creates in me that realization of a lack of integrity, which produces that anxiety we've been talking about. So where do we go from there? What would we say to Pascal? Well, we can use reason to know what is clear about God from general revelation. And as you look at Pascal, I suspect that instead he puts the knowledge of God in the area of special revelation. And so implicit in his analysis of reason and faith, of reason and the emotions, is also analysis of reason and faith. And it's the non-cognitive, or that's the mystical element, or special revelation, those are different, that lead us to God, not there's a clear general revelation, which is what we need to be able to show. And it is interesting that even people who speak very highly of mathematics can end up, and maybe they those all the more, end up in a kind of mysticism. Because mathematics doesn't get them to highest reality, they say the only way to do it then is by a non-cognitive experience of the highest realm. That's the mysticism. And so you'll have both of them in the same person. And so then isn't that, though, bringing us back now to Ecclesiastes, isn't that what the preacher's saying? No, not at all. The preacher's saying life under the sun is meaningless. And under the sun represents the natural man, the person who takes no care or interest in God, merely interested in his own life, his stomach, his banking account. And that life is meaningless. It adds up to nothing. That's like the picture Pascal was giving of this brief amount of time you're here. It's meaningless. It's vanity. Think of all the cares and concerns a person puts into their life. And it's just emptiness. It's just vanity. But the conclusion of the matter is not there. That reality of meaninglessness should turn us from our condition of vanity, or the anxiety we feel that points out that internal lack of integrity. That should point us to reject it. To turn away from it and say, no, life is more than that. There must be something more than that. And it's not just that it's a Hail Mary or a Hail Mary pass or a blind leap that we saw in Kierkegaard. No, not at all. I should have knowledge. So it's not merely because it's not wish fulfillment. Like, oh, I just wish I knew more, but it would make life great. Life is meaningless without knowledge, but we don't really have knowledge, but let's just pretend we do. That's wish fulfillment. That's not what the preacher in Ecclesiastes is telling us. How he concludes the matter is, the conclusion of the matter is that we should fear God and keep his commandments. Now, what does that mean? Fear God and keep his commandments. Fear God means it's not craven fear, which is pretty much the only way we use the term now. The fear of God, the awe of God, the realization of who God is, the eternal power and divine nature of God. God alone is eternal. God alone has existed from eternity. All else had a beginning. And God alone has the power to create. That's the infinite power of God, that God can bring things into existence. And so you start there with that awe, that realization of who God is and who we are, by contrast, that we're created by God, we're not gods. We can't become gods. We aren't currently gods. We don't become gods. We are always a creature made by God, made in the image of God, but not God. And then keep God's law, the moral law, written on our hearts. That moral law beginning with the realization of who God is. Love the Lord your God. So that's a law from general revelation, although it's summarized in special revelation under the Ten Commandments. It's knowable from general revelation. You could know that you should love the Lord God. You should know from general revelation that you shouldn't make images and call them your God. You should know from general revelation that you shouldn't treat these things with vanity, lightly, disregarding. You could know from general revelation the relationship between work and rest and the purpose of human work. You could know from general revelation how authority works. Authority in teaching, a parent teaching a child, and what a parent ought to know to teach a child. You can know from general relation about human dignity and what it means to act consistently with human dignity and what it means to act in contrast or in violation of human dignity. You can know from general relation about fidelity and the importance of both spiritual and ordinary fidelity. You can know from general revelation about how value and talents work so that you don't end up stealing what is of value. And you can know from general revelation about the relationship between truth and justice, that you need to know the truth in order to have justice. And finally, you can know from general revelation that suffering can't keep you from what is good. That when you understand what is good, all things work together for that good in you. So you can know God, and you can know God's moral law. And those are precisely the things that we need to know to address anxiety. Now I'm not suggesting that this overcomes anxiety. There are other contributing factors to what we use the word anxiety to cover. But it does address what I've been speaking of here as existential anxiety. You might find yourself getting anxious and you have to reflect, you have to calm down and remember these things. Remember them. That's spoken of often in the Psalms. Recall them to mind, the deeds of God, the creation and providence of God. And that's what will put an end to the age of skepticism. Being able to faithfully speak to our ability to know these things. And with the age of skepticism coming to an end, the age of anxiety would come to an end as well. As we come to know both our origin and our destiny, our purpose, that we're not an accident. We're not merely a speck of dust with no purpose, but we come to see the glory revealed in God's works of creation and providence. So thank you for joining me in this series on anxiety in the modern world. We'll see you next time.